Thank you for the very kind introduction. I'm always amazed at how little information can be conveyed in an introduction. All that was said is true. I do spend very little time at home with my family. But it seems to me the most important thing about me is that I'm an urban enthusiast. I like cities. I like to walk through them, ride through them, talk about them, experience them. And I guess I also have some great limitations. One of the greatest limitations I have is that I'm very much oriented to the physical landscape, or as I prefer to call it, the cultural landscape. What I can see, what I can feel, what I can sense with my physical presence. The other limitation I have is that I'm constantly amazed at things. I'm constantly taken by surprise when I think about the present, think about the past, or think about the future. So I sort of think of myself as a rather naive 30-year-old wandering around the city, enjoying myself, and somehow I've convinced society to pay for it. And I'm afraid one of these days I'm going to wake up and find that somebody's caught up with me. But before I launch off into my discourse on neighborhoods, I should tell you a little bit about geography. It started, I think, basically because people were curious about places. And for most of our history, we've been exploring faraway places. Unfortunately for me, most of the faraway places have been explored. But unfortunately for our society, many of the places close in had been ignored. So I turned traditional focus of geography in exploration and trying to understand the world, I turned it in on the city in which I live and teach, and I started to explore St. Paul. So I come to you today very much in the frame of mind of a Victorian returning from the antipodes. I suppose, since many of you, I assume, are from Minneapolis, I have indeed come from the antipodes, from St. Paul. In any case, I want to talk to you about some very specific places, and I'd like to have you think of them as examples. The lecture you just heard is truly one of the most concise and best treatments of urban problems present and into the future I've ever heard. And what I'd like to do is not in any sense compliment that, but try to, if I can, make it more personal. Tie it into specific places in specific times. Geographers like myself believe in the tyranny of place, that no matter what we think about in general terms, this all has to come down to earth somewhere. And the reality we walk through can be used, if we're careful, to enable us to understand some of these major general themes and problems that we've just heard described. A second major problem or hesitation I have is that while we talk about the future 20 years from now, we have a great deal of trouble foretelling what will happen tomorrow. And in the work I've been doing with neighborhoods and commercial strips, most of the concern of the residents or other occupants of the areas has been not with the year 2000, but with 1977. And so I've tried to think a little bit about the close future as well. Now, I like to do that because, as was indicated earlier, it's fairly easy to talk in science fiction terms about the future because we won't be here. Nobody will be able to say that Lannergan was an absolute ass that didn't happen at all. But we're going to be here in 1980. And if we make some interpretation about the future in the near future, that's wrong. People will be around to call us to task. Okay, I'd like to look at three different sorts of neighborhoods or three different sorts of places. The first, Swede Hollow and the east side of St. Paul. The second, a fraction of the historic Hill District of St. Paul called Crocus Hill. And third, a street called Grand Avenue. I want to use these places to examine the following things: the implication of population expansion in the Twin Cities, the implications of changes in transportation technology, thirdly, the changes in human attitudes toward the city, fourthly, the changing relationships among parts of the metropolitan area, fifth, impact of economic growth, sixth, design and standards. I will undoubtedly be unable to refrain from commenting on governmental policy as well as we go along. Now, I've been greatly amused by this task before me because I'm going to show some slides now, and I assume there is some sort of radio audience. So if you'll just shut your eyes and pretend you're listening to the Lone Ranger or something like that, try to imagine these marvelous scenes in St. Paul. And hopefully I'll whet your curiosity enough to take a little trip and visit us in the city and see some of these things for yourself. So if we could show the slides now, please. Now, the major point I'd like to leave with you is that cities come and go in pieces, that they're modular. They're like our bodies. We're continually dying and being regenerated. Cities are like that. Pieces come and go. And they change their function as society changes around them. Now, the first place I want to talk about is a very small spot called Swede Hollow over on the east side. You can see it generally on this map. Payne Avenue is probably the nearest well-known place name, or the Hams Brewery. Now, the area was settled in the middle of the last century by people like this gentleman. As you can see, his wants were simple, and his housekeeping rather untidy. You can make a lot of inferences, I suppose, about the present status of the city. But the housing was very simple, very economical, and largely self-constructed. Now, Swede Hollow was formed by Phalen Creek and very early became the locus of manufacturing, basically milling and brewing on the creek. It's hard to imagine them using Phalen Creek to make beer, but they did. And the place looked like this. Now, in this picture, taken from the bluff of the Hollow about 1900, we can see several things about the city and about the people's life within it. Here is Phalen Creek flowing through the floor of the valley. 30 years before, this had been a trout stream, a wild place where people came and hunted and took pastoral walks. Here is a cart track that comes along the creek. You see here it's very deeply rutted and has a lot of water in it. And then various houses, as I indicated early, largely vernacular or home-built, built by the residents. At this time, the population of the Hollow is comprised of Swedes and Norwegians. There is no city water here. They get their water from a spring, which is out of sight. And this accounts for the basic plumbing or sanitation facilities. Up here, the railroad tracks that use the Hollow routeway north toward Duluth, the high-income families up on the hill, the stories of women going to the edge and shaking their dust mops over the edge down into the Hollow and express their disdain for the Swedes down there. Here's Ham's Brewery. By this time, most of that industry shown in the previous slide had been abandoned. Here is the Ham's Mansion up on the hill. Now, there are several things in this slide that indicate changing transportation and industrial technology. First, these people here have to walk to work. It takes time to get to work, so that these, like most people in the city in this era, tried to live as close to their jobs as possible, so they tended to crowd around the major locations of employment. The reason for the Ham's Mansion is quite complex. You can see just over the horizon there are several other mansions along the street behind. But one of the major reasons, of course, is that these people were proud of their occupations. They were not ashamed of being captains of industry, and in fact they kind of liked it. Could get up in the morning, take a look at that black smokestack, and think of the dollars that they were going to make that day. In any case, in the city of this era, the wealthy were not miles from the poor. They were separated. That is quite a distance, social distance up that hill. But these people were about as poor as anybody in St. Paul. And while the Ham's family were not the most wealthiest, they certainly were among the wealthy. Close up shows you a little better some of the buildings. And here you see an interesting area called Arlington Heights. And it's to this area that the Swedes moved to as they made enough money, as they got Americanized, as they learned English. They moved up out of the hollow, up onto the highlands north. And I'll have a good deal to say about that later. But this physical movement called locally moving up the street or moving up on the street, it's a very important part of the change here, as this neighborhood was one through which people passed, not one in which they stayed. People tended to like it. They certainly were not ashamed of being residents of Sweet Hollow because they viewed it as a temporary resting place. You can see now in here, this is an area beyond government. There are no city streets platted. As I mentioned before, there were no services. The sheriff came down here occasionally, but not regularly. And the land title is very confused. Sometimes these people paid taxes, and sometimes they didn't. But this is essentially the best example of laissez-faire government policy in housing and urban planning that I think you can ever see, certainly here in the Twin Cities. And here you can see again the polluted creek, the kinds of facilities available to these people, and the general kind of unkept roughness of the area. Now this is another part of the ravine. This is called Connemara Patch. This is where the Irish lived. There was a great deal of friction among the Irish and the Swedes. And there was also some residential segregation in this neighborhood. As I indicated, this was an immigrant neighborhood, largely inhabited by Europeans, a place where they came to originally. There are stories about large numbers of people getting off the railroad train in St. Paul with a tag on their lapel that said Gentile Yeruso. And Mr. Yeruso met these immigrants at the train, and they walked from the depot into Swede Hollow, which by 1905 was essentially Italian. And this is where they lived until they learned to speak English, until they got acclimatized, until they began to develop some sort of social network, some kind of system of organization that would enable them to take control of their future, until they essentially moved out of this hole and up into American society. And these are the houses that they moved into. These were houses built around 1860 by Germans and people from the eastern U.S. They built these houses in an area called Railroad Triangle, which is immediately adjacent to the Hollow, just west of Payne Avenue. They moved into these houses as they were abandoned by the older immigrants, and so this area then became home to Italians. And the older houses, built as they were for middle-income families, began to trickle down to these lower-income immigrant families. This is a basic kind of model people have about the city. New housing is supposedly built for the highest income, and as they move into that, they abandon their housing and it trickles on or filters down to the lower income groups. Here you see some old houses as well. The interesting thing here is I'm standing in some vacant land. The area used to be as densely built as the other side of the street. Now, through government intervention, basically through highway building, the area has been greatly decreased. The area in housing has been greatly decreased. So there's much more open space now than there was 20 years ago. Now, this is a home of one of the managers, owners of Ham's Brewery. This is across the street from that mansion I showed you in the earlier slide. And as you can see, it's no longer the opulent mansion it once was. It's been subdivided and has effectively filtered down. So this area that once, 70 years ago, was an elite, very restricted neighborhood has now changed. It hasn't, there hasn't been any sort of dramatic uprooting and rebuilding. It's just changed. Pieces have been added and pieces have been taken away. I think that's what's going to happen in the future. Houses like this one, built as it was just before World War I by the owner, that is by the person who occupied it, he dug the basement himself with the help of a hired horse, once housed a first generation Swede. It's passed through several hands since that time, and the neighborhood has gradually changed. It hasn't had any tremendous turnover, but it's quite a different place now than it was. Same as with this home, this one built 20 years later, has also undergone the same kind of gradual shift. The neighborhood has changed very gradually. So when you walk through it, it looks very stable. But there's constant change going on. The street, Payne Avenue, the commercial core for the East Side, once dominated by stores like this one of Wilfred Anderson, a first-generation Swedish immigrant, ironically enough fled Sweden to avoid the draft and then got drafted to fight in the First World War here. But a street of small merchants who carried many people on credit and essentially supported the neighborhood with private investment. Now, at one time, there were some 200 stores on Payne Avenue. They're gradually decreasing in number. This kind of cement, the cement of credit, economic credit in the neighborhood, is decreasing and disappearing. And so the neighborhood, again, is undergoing a very subtle but probably very significant change. Social institutions like the churches, of course, came later. The East Side has some distinctive ones. Basically, the Swedish Battalion of the Salvation Army, which gives the area some distinctiveness with its revivals. This story is here about the infernal Irish throwing rocks at the drums during the Salvation Army services until the Salvation Army got some vigilantes to protect them from the Irish. And it also developed its own sort of culture. I guess there's not too much we can say about this. These are, of course, Scandinavian American entertainers of some high repute at the time of the First War, early 1920s. This is Ole Skrathholt and his famous million seller, Nicolina. Now, this is the Hollow today. It's empty. The houses are gone, the people are gone. The function that this area served is by and large no longer needed. It was a place for European immigrants to become Americanized, to learn English, to get some jobs, to get into the system, and to, in their vernacular, move up on the street. But the flow, as you know, the flow of immigrants from Europe is over. In addition, the city fathers have expanded their control. And they're trying to remove the areas of the city that were not dominated by them, the city government. And so in this particular place, they simply set it on fire. This happened in 1956. The fire department burned it down. I always thought that was very significant because there's that marvelous science fiction story, Fahrenheit 451, in which the fire department doesn't put out fires, it burns books. But here in 1956, we have the fire department burning houses. Now, they burned this neighborhood for good reasons. It was unhealthful. They said the city, or the spring that served as its water supply had been contaminated, and these people were in danger of their lives. So they burned it down. Now today, you can go there, and it looks like this. Phelan Creek is now in a very large culvert buried in the bottom here. You can't see it. This is taken from the site of the Hams Mansion. So we're looking sort of southwest down the creek. Now, this whole neighborhood is gone. It lasted less than 100 years. It served a very important function, but that function was no longer needed. In addition, people's attitudes toward the quality of urban life had changed very slowly, and the opportunities available to the lowest income groups in the city opened up, and so they really didn't have to live here. Now, one of the unfortunate things about Swede Hollow is that it's romanticized. People look back on it with a great deal of nostalgia and talk about what a nice, supportive community lived in Swede Hollow. But if you look at it sort of from the public health view, it was not a nice place. And so we have two values colliding. One, the supportive neighborhood, the community of friends. And secondly, the attitudes toward quality of housing, quality of water, and sewage disposal. And the two collided, and Swede Hollow is green again. This is the site of the Hams Mansion. A little different history, this one burned down by vandals. I suppose you could argue that it's not such a different history. But if you walk into Swede Hollow, you can see some of the remains of the houses, hand-built foundations, as I indicated, and then now this sort of green park. Now, this is one possible future for older inner city neighborhoods. They can disappear, and they can revert into open space or some kind of recreational area and no longer house people. It's a very real possibility. There are several examples of it here in the Twin Cities. The second area I want to talk to you about is Crocus Hill. As you can see, it's I guess you can't really see that map up in the upper left corner in red locates Crocus Hill in the city of St. Paul. But essentially Summit Avenue in its lower stretches runs through the northern side. And we see it marked here, Grand Avenue to Pleasant to St. Clair and Victoria. It's essentially on a crest of the terrace of the Mississippi. Here you see that bluff a little better. This area was developed by speculators, as were most of the areas in the Twin Cities. Real estate promoters who bought the land and developed it. This one, of course, they developed for the very wealthy. This is a house called the Schiermeier House, which is now no longer standing. But the area was designed, intended to be the home of the wealthy, just the opposite of Swede Hollow. It was made possible by transportation technology. It was some distance from downtown when it was opened in the 70s, but the advent of the street railroad, or as we know it more commonly as the streetcar, mass transportation during this era, made it possible for people to live out on the fringe of the city, the suburbs, and commute in downtown. In 86, they were building houses like this one, for Crocus Hill. In the later 80s, early 90s, they were building houses that looked like this. I'm going to run through a series of slides here which are about 3 to 5 years apart. So we're at about 1890 here. 92, 95 here. The middle of the 1890s, late 1890s, about 1900. Same with this one, about 1900. Now, if you look carefully at these, I'm not going to give you time to, but you'll just have to imagine it. You'll see subtle changes in style, subtle changes in architecture, but they're on the same general theme. As I said, these are all about a 3-year interval. Now we're up into the 19-teens. You see if you can recall back to the first one I showed you, the one from 86. In this 30-year span, houses in the same neighborhood, that is really maybe 200, 300 yards apart at the most, have changed a good deal. Subtle changes, but constant change. As the neighborhood is changing constantly, it's filling in. New styles are coming in, and new building materials are used. Now, this house is, in fact, across the street from the first house I showed you, the red brick built in 86. And scenes like this, old photograph, of course, are impossible to duplicate now because the neighborhood, the suburb, was filled in. As housing technology changed, land value increased, people could afford to come in and fill in this hole that the child is sliding in and build a house on top of it. A close-up of her. The automobile, as everybody knows, emerged in the 20s. The transportation mode shifts, and we move into the era of personalized rapid transit, PRT, or the car. We lay down a network for it called roads, and everything's going along just great. And the people who were living in this old suburb, a suburb of the late 19th century, fill it in. Their children move to the suburbs of the 50s. The first, as far as I've been able to tell, the Crocus Hill neighborhood was filled in 1928. There were some houses that were torn down or burned down and rebuilt upon, but beginning in the 30s, this movement out occurred, and it reached its peak in the 1950s, as we've just heard. Now, what I'm trying to indicate in this map is that this neighborhood, this Crocus Hill neighborhood, didn't just disappear. The segment of the community that was occupying it is still in the metropolitan area, but they have changed locations. And their tastes are much the same as the people who developed the neighborhood in the late 19th century had, a pastoral, private place. Now today, those locations are found in the fringe, places like Sunfish Lake, North Oaks, generally White Bear, parts of Mendota Heights. But there's a very interesting but going on here. Crocus Hill has not disappeared. It's essentially been, Something very exciting is going on. It's undergoing a renaissance. And instead of the houses gradually turning into buildings that look like that mansion I showed you earlier from the east side, new families are coming in, Some of them descended from the old families, some of them new to the Twin Cities, have come in and begun to fill. Something very exciting is going on. It's undergoing a renaissance. And instead of the houses gradually turning into buildings that look like that mansion I showed you earlier from the east side, new families are coming in. Some of them descended from the old families, some of them new to the Twin Cities, have come in and begun to filter up this housing. And they're putting a lot of work in it. Rebuilding, repairing, restoring, rehabilitation. Largely, I would venture to say, nearly exclusively private capital. And seemingly what's happened here is that the scarce resource, old houses, fine old houses, have now become so valuable that they have become essentially an antique. And we have live-in or wraparound antiques, and people want to buy them. Now, what's happened here is that, you know, a lot of things have happened here, but one of the most important ones is a change in taste, a change in lifestyle among one segment of the population. In addition, the declining options, that is, you simply can't find new houses like these old houses. And so if you have one, you have something no one can duplicate. If you have a new house built by an architect, nearly anybody can duplicate that. But these old houses can't be copied. They can be changed. They can be made to conform to contemporary style of life and sense of what's proper architecture. Some of them changed dramatically. Some simply maintained. This house, by the way, was built by Louis Hill. It's now occupied by the head of the Minnesota Geological Survey, a professional person who works here at the university. And the neighborhood is much more confident about its future than it was just a decade ago. And the young children, the young families growing up in the neighborhood have a spirit about them, a supportive community developing not as a result of government programming. And some people argue this confidence, this hope for the future, and this private investment occurs in spite of government programming. The next place I want to talk to you about is one that's one of my favorites, Grand Avenue. This is a street the likes of which Jane Jacobs would like to live on. It's a mixture of houses, apartments, stores, restaurants, bars. Started out like most streets in St. Paul, commercial streets in St. Paul did. Streetcar, some scattered commercial development. Try to remember this building. It's the oldest building still standing on Grand Avenue, and I'm going to show you some pictures of it as it is today. This photo is unfortunately undated, so I don't know exactly what era it's from, but it's around 1900. As I said, it's occupied by a variety of people. One of the major population sectors is the elderly. They live in the old apartments. They ride the bus free between 9 and 3. They go downtown St. Paul to the Wilder Senior Citizens Center. They shop along the avenue in grocery stores and clothing stores and so on. Now, essentially, I want to emphasize this because these people live in a linear neighborhood. We tend to think of neighborhoods as squares. But these people live on a line. They live on a transportation line. Another group are the young couples. As was pointed out, the most important child in home ownership seems to be the second child. So there are large numbers of young families with no children or just one child living in the older apartments, the bigger apartments along the avenue. And then there are simply the young couples without children also attracted to the housing. And then the student population. All of these people live in a neighborhood. They don't all occupy the same space, but they occupy positions on this line, this transportation line through the neighborhood. They patronize different shops. They live in the different styles of apartments, but they're all here together, and they are essentially integrated much more so than in most parts of the city. They live in single-family houses. They live in old houses like this one from about 1917, which is not a single-family house. These houses are showing their age. Some of them are, most of them are all built before 1920. Most of them are wooden, and many of them have not been kept up. Lots of these old apartments built when people took the streetcars, so there are no garages with them. These houses are this apartment block is technically illegal. It has too great a density for the modern zoning ordinance. There are also apartments like this, which occupy the site previously of two houses, or previously occupied by two houses, and like this. Now, these are suburban style apartments. They're security, you have to buzz and lock and all this business. So that the street has maintained this apartment function for 60 years. And in fact, there's an apartment building going up right today on the avenue. It's still happening. It still has this historic function of a transportation corridor with multifamily units along it. Now, this is the building I showed you when we first began, the oldest building on the avenue. I want to show it to you because you can see how functions can adapt to space, and that locations may change, as relative locations may change. The buildings themselves still can accommodate new purposes, new functions. And this is one of the major problems with the city, I think anyway, is adapting it, finding ways to adapt the physical location, the physical landscape, to changes in relationships among parts and among people. This one is pretty easy. You simply slap some paint on the brick and put in some small shops. Now, the street, in addition to serving as home for large numbers of people, is a place of employment. And there are several different sorts. One of the major sorts are these things called which I call personal services, places you go to have somebody work on your body. The second major group is the craft and art gallery function that's localized on Grand Avenue serves it's just the opposite of the ones we just looked at. The ones we just looked at are convenience functions. These are functions you'll travel some distance to avail yourself of. And there are a lot of galleries of various sorts, antiques. This one's specializing in Persian rugs. Here's an art gallery specializing in contemporary American art. Here's one craft gallery. In addition, there are some associated activities. There are two picture framers on the avenue. One of them so large and profitable that he has just taken over an old grocery store. The third major group are the craftspeople. I like to call Grand Avenue the Street of Craftsmen. The old buildings, the small quarters, the low rent, make the place perfect for people who are just beginning economic activity. And in the contemporary society, with the reemergence of craft-type activities, the street has been a logical place for these to localize on. So we have this one, the proprietor of the Leather Indian. This isn't a craft, but it's one of the places I visit most frequently on the avenue. Baker, another shot of a baker. Hairdresser, somebody who can work on foreign cars. If you have one, you know how valuable these people are. Florists, people who work on clothing. And these all mesh together, these three kinds of activities, with the more traditional retail establishments, hardware stores, paint stores, appliance stores, clothing stores. And their service area looks something like this. Nearly 100% of the clients of the merchants on Grand Avenue come from within that broadest circle, the light blue. 75% within the purple, and 50% within the yellow. So you see, it serves not the entire metropolitan area, but a good chunk of it. And it serves, you know, different functions have their own trade area, so that you can change pieces of it, and the total pattern will vary accordingly. Sort of like a plate of spaghetti. When you stick your fork in one side and wiggle, something wiggles on the other side. And it's awfully hard to determine exactly the connections among them. And that's the way these neighborhoods are. That's the way Grand Avenue is. The banker, very traditional sort of banker. Decorators, the traditional businessmen, are on the avenue with a non-traditional business. And there are other non-traditional businesses on the avenue that I don't have pictures of. But these men are all in this thing together in a way that is difficult to delineate exactly, but they are all related. I mentioned some of the specialty shops. This is Martin's Restaurant, essentially an elderly person's restaurant, so I'm told, but it certainly has some of the best food. But there are delicatessens, rather mainline restaurants, some offbeat restaurants like this one, and some that claim to serve the neighborhood but actually serve the downtown businessmen and politicians on their lunch hours, and some rather exotic ones coming in, again making themselves available to the rather high-income market area of Grand Avenue, and the availability of cheap space. However, there are some invaders, some businesses associated with the automotive industry, the fast food franchises. There are two on the avenue. Recently, the city council got around to reacting to neighborhood pressure throughout the city and has essentially outlawed fast food franchises within the limits of St. Paul. But it's taken a long time for the neighborhood feeling about this kind of economic activity to percolate up to the level of city council. As I've alluded to several times before, the key to this neighborhood is transportation. Now, it started as a streetcar. The buses are really streetcars. They didn't really do much except follow the same tracks in this part of the city. And so we have a change in mode, but not a change in route. The PRTs, the cars, had a great impact on the neighborhood around it. But the presence of the mass transit, the bus, has maintained the attractiveness of the neighborhood for several groups. First of all, the young who either can't afford or for philosophical reasons decide not to have a car, and the elderly. This is probably, as I've indicated before, the major features of the street for the senior citizen. And again, I want to indicate that there are two things working here. One, unintended. Nobody planned this street to be a locus for independent elderly people, but the government policy of subsidizing transportation for the elderly has maintained the viability of the street. The car has created lots of problems, as well as setting up several kinds of economic activities along the avenue. There are gas stations, which are fewer than there were 3 years ago, some of these associated activities, and some automobile dealers, which are going through an interesting transformation from mainline American cars to smaller, more exotic foreign cars. The biggest problem that the merchants and apartment dwellers face is simply what to do with the things. Can't leave them on the street. There are really too many, so there's various kinds of hodgepodge of strategies developing to park cars either for the apartment dwellers or for the customers, and it's a constant source of irritation. This solution is pretty drastic. Two houses were torn down here to make room for a parking lot, which, although it is owned by my college, I think you'll have to admit is singularly unattractive and unimaginative. And this is one of the major problems in the sense of the design of this part of the city, is how to blend in the features of the automotive or any variation of personalized rapid transit storage into a part of the city built essentially for mass transit. I'm sure you've heard the saying, one picture is worth a thousand lies. This is a good example. This is a trick shot taken with a telephoto lens to exaggerate the traffic congestion, but nonetheless, there is some. Now, as we think about the near future and the energy situation, the future of the automobile and transportation, many people are discussing the impossibility of using the bicycle given the present pattern of traffic. Not only is it very dangerous, but if you get stuck at a red light behind one of these cars spewing out carbon monoxide, it's not very pleasant either. But one of the things that has to be done in the near future is figure out what to do with the existing technology, how to make it compatible. And while we're waiting for the personalized rapid transit to come, what are we going to do? Another problem is the safety of people and products along the avenue. Another thing is what to do with buildings when they change, become, I want to say obsolete, but when the functions that they were built for become obsolete. I was walking down the street a couple of weeks ago with a tour from the Back to the Cities conference, and I showed them this building and said, "Now, isn't that a nice example of rehab?" And one of the visitors, who is an expert on sign law and street furniture, just about killed me, saying that it's a bad example. So here you are. This is either a good or a bad example of rehab. You can make up your own mind. Now, this slide is going to stick up. It was fixed. Here's a sort of cosmetic job, a little more imaginative cosmetic job, and then this kind of activity where a building built for one function, basically residential, has been completely transformed. Here's another one, and another. And this is probably the worst example. Now, the interesting decision that I would like to talk to you about is that the title of this, Metro 2000, It's Our Responsibility, there's a pattern going on here of conversion, slow, piecemeal change. You can see it if you take a couple of years to measure it. But when you just take a quick look, everything looks like it's always been this way. But there is this change going on, and it's at a level that individual residents, either as political members or members of social action groups, can do something about. Because there's not really too much we can do about regional multi-state governments. But we can make some decisions about conversion of buildings or conversions, changes of small areas.